were blackened and swollen. Adam sat very still, looking at her. Her set and splinted arm lay on her stomach, but her right arm lay on top of the coverlet, the fingers curled like a nest. It was a child's hand, almost a baby's hand. Adam touched her wrist with his finger, and her fingers moved a little in reflex. Her wrist was warm. Secretly, then, as though he were afraid he might be caught, he straightened her hand and touched the little cushion pads on the fingertips. Her fingers were pink and soft, but the skin on the back of her hand seemed to have an underbloom like a pearl. Adam chuckled with delight. Her breathing stopped, and he became electrically alert. Then her throat clicked, and the rhythmed snoring continued. Gently, he worked her hand and arm under the cover before he tiptoed out of the room. For several days, Kathy lay in a cave of shock and opium. Her skin felt like lead, and she moved very little because of the pain. She was aware of movement around her. Gradually, her head and her eyes cleared. Two young men were with her, one occasionally and the other a great deal. She knew that another man who came in was the doctor, and there was also a tall, lean man who interested her more than any of the others, and the interest grew out of fear. Perhaps in her drugged sleep she had picked something up and stored it. Very slowly her mind assembled the last days and rearranged them. She saw the face of Mr. Edwards, saw it lose its placid self-sufficiency and dissolve into murder. She had never been so afraid before in her life, but she had learned fear now, and her mind sniffed about like a rat looking for an escape. Mr. Edwards knew about the fire. Did anyone else? And how did he know? A blind, nauseating terror rose in her when she thought of that. From things she heard, she learned that the tall man was the sheriff and wanted to question her, and that the young man named Adam was protecting her from the questioning. Maybe the sheriff knew about the fire. Raised voices gave her the clue to her method. The sheriff said, "She must have a name. Somebody must know her." "How could she answer? Her jaw is broken." Adam's voice. "If she's right-handed, she could spell out answers. Look here, Adam, if somebody tried to kill her, I'd better catch him while I can. Just give me a pencil and let me talk to her." Adam said, "You heard the doctor say her skull was cracked. How do you know she can remember?" "Well, you give me a paper and pencil and we'll see." "I don't want you to bother her." "Adam, goddammit, it doesn't matter what you want. I'm telling you I want a paper and pencil." Then the other young man's voice. "What's the matter with you? You make it sound like it was you who did it. Give him a pencil." She had her eyes closed when the three men came quietly into her room. "She's asleep," Adam whispered. She opened her eyes and looked at them. The tall man came to the side of the bed. "I don't want to bother you, miss. I'm the sheriff. I know you can't talk, but will you just write some things on this?" She tried to nod and winced with pain. She blinked her eyes rapidly to indicate assent. "That's the girl," said the sheriff. "You see, she wants to." He put the tablet on the bed beside her and molded her fingers around the pencil. "There we are. Now, what is your name?" The three men watched her face. Her mouth grew thin and her eyes squinted. She closed her eyes and the pencil began to move. "I don't know," it scrawled in huge letters. "Here now, there's a fresh sheet. What do you remember?" "All black. Can't think," the pencil wrote before it went over the edge of the tablet. "Don't you remember who you are? Where you came from? Think." She seemed to go through a great struggle, and then her face gave up and became tragic. "No, mixed up. Help me." "Poor child," the sheriff said. "I thank you for trying anyway. When you get better, we'll try again. No, you don't have to write any more. The pencil wrote, "Thank you," and fell from her fingers. She had won the sheriff. He ranged himself with Adam. Only Charles was against her. When the brothers were in her room, and it took two of them to help her on the bedpan without hurting her, she studied Charles' dark sullenness. He had something in his face that she recognized, that made her uneasy. She saw that he touched the scar on his forehead very often, rubbed it, and drew its outline with his fingers. Once he caught her watching. He looked guiltily at his fingers. Charles said brutally, "Don't you worry. You're going to have one like it, maybe even a better one." She smiled at him, and he looked away. When Adam came in with her warm soup, Charles said, "I'm going to town and drink some beer." Adam couldn't remember ever having been so happy. It didn't bother him that he didn't know her name. She had said to call her Kathy, and that was enough for him. He cooked for Kathy, going through recipes used by his mother and his stepmother. Kathy's vitality was great. She began to recover very quickly. The swelling went out of her cheeks, and the prettiness of convalescence came to her face. In a short time, she could be helped to a sitting position. She opened and closed her mouth very carefully, and she began to eat soft foods that required little chewing. The bandage was still on her forehead, but the rest of her face was little marked, except for the hollow cheek on the side where the teeth were missing. Kathy was in trouble, and her mind ranged for a way out of it. She spoke little, even when it was not so difficult. One afternoon, she heard someone moving around in the kitchen. She called, "Adam, is it you?" Charles' voice answered, "No, it's me."
"Would you come in here just for a minute, please?"
He stood in the doorway. His eyes were sullen.
"You don't come in much," she said.
"That's right."
"You don't like me."
"I guess that's right, too."
"Will you tell me why?"
He struggled to find an answer. "I don't trust you."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. And I don't believe you lost your memory."
"But why should I lie?"
"I don't know. That's why I don't trust you. There's something I almost recognize."
"You never saw me in your life."
"Maybe not, but there's something that bothers me, that I ought to know." "And how do you know I never saw you?" She was silent, and he moved to leave.
"Don't go," she said. "What do you intend to do?"
"About what?"
"About me."
He regarded her with a new interest. "You want the truth?"
"Why else would I ask?"
"I don't know, but I'll tell you. I'm going to get you out of here just as soon as I can. My brother's turned fool, but I'll bring him around if I have to lick him."
"Could you do that? He's a big man."
"I could do it."
She regarded him levelly. "Where is Adam?"
"Gone in town to get some more of your goddamn medicine."
"You're a mean man."
"You know what I think? I don't think I'm half as mean as you are under that nice skin. I think you're a devil."
She laughed softly. "That makes two of us," she said. "Charles, how long do I have?"
"For what?"
"How long before you put me out? Tell me truly."
"All right, I will. About a week or 10 days, as soon as you can get around."
"Suppose I don't go?"
He regarded her craftily, almost with pleasure at the thought of combat. "All right, I'll tell you. When you had all that dope, you talked a lot, like in your sleep."
"I don't believe that."
He laughed, for he had seen the quick tightening of her mouth. "All right, don't. But if you just go about your business as soon as you can, I won't tell.
But if you don't, you'll know all right, and so will the sheriff.
I don't believe I said anything bad. What could I say?
I won't argue with you, and I've got work to do. You asked me, and I told you.
He went outside. Back of the hen house, he leaned over and laughed and slapped his leg.
I thought she was smarter, he said to himself.
And he felt more easy than he had for days. Charles had frightened her badly. And if he had recognized her, so had she recognized him. He was the only person she had ever met who played it her way. Kathy followed his thinking, and it didn't reassure her. She knew that her tricks wouldn't work with him, and she needed protection and rest. Her money was gone. She had to be sheltered, and would have to be for a long time. She was tired and sick, but her mind went skipping among possibilities. Adam came back from town with a bottle of painkiller. He poured a tablespoonful.
"This'll taste horrible," he said. "It's good stuff, though."
She took it without protest. Didn't even make much of a face about it.
"You're good to me," she said. "I wonder why. I brought you trouble."
"You have not. You've brightened up the whole house. Never complain or anything? Hurt as bad as you are?"
"You're so good. So kind."
"I want to be."
"Do you have to go out? Couldn't you stay and talk to me?"
"Sure I could. There's nothing so important to do."
"Draw up a chair, Adam, and sit down."
When he was seated, she stretched her right hand toward him, and he took it in both of his.
"So good and kind," she repeated. "Adam, you keep promises, don't you?"
"I try to. What are you thinking about?"
"I'm alone and I'm afraid," she cried. "I'm afraid."
"Can I help you?"
"I don't think anyone can help me."
"Tell me and let me try."
"That's the worst part. I can't even tell you."
"Why not? If it's a secret, I won't tell it."
"It's not my secret, don't you see?"
"No, I don't."
Her fingers gripped his hand tightly.
"Adam, I didn't ever lose my memory."
"Well, then why did you say?"
"That's what I'm trying to tell you. Did you love your father, Adam?"
"I guess I revered him more than loved him."
"Well, if someone you revered were in trouble, wouldn't you do anything to save him from destruction?"
"Well, sure, I guess I would."
"Well, that's how it is with me."
"But how did you get hurt?"
"That's part of it. That's why I can't tell."
"Was it your father?"
"Oh, no. But it's all tied up together."
"You mean, if you tell me who hurt you, then your father will be in trouble?"
She sighed. He would make up the story himself.
"Adam, will you trust me?"
"Of course."
"It's an awful thing to ask."
"No, it isn't. Not if you're protecting your father."
"You understand, it's not my secret. If it were, I'd tell you in a minute."
"Of course I understand. I do the same thing myself."
"Oh, you understand so much."
Tears welled up in her eyes. He leaned down toward her, and she kissed him on the cheek.
"Don't you worry," he said. "I'll take care of you."
She lay back against the pillow.
"I don't think you can."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, your brother doesn't like me. He wants me to get out of here."
"Did he tell you that?"
"Oh, no. I can just feel it. He hasn't your understanding."
"He has a good heart."
"I know that, but he doesn't have your kindness. And when I have to go, the sheriff is going to begin asking questions, and I'll be all alone."
He stared into space.
"My brother can't make you go. I own half of this farm. I have my own money."
"If he wanted me to go, I would have to. I can't spoil your life."
Adam stood up and strode out of the room. He went to the back door and looked out on the afternoon. Far off in the field, his brother was lifting stones from a sled and piling them on the stone wall. Adam looked up at the sky. A blanket of herring clouds was rolling in from the east. He sighed deeply, and his breath made a tickling, exciting feeling in his chest. His ears seemed suddenly clear, so that he heard the chickens cackling and the east wind blowing over the ground. He heard horses' hoofs plodding on the road, and far off, pounding on wood where a neighbor was shingling a barn. And all these sounds related into a kind of music. His eyes were clear, too. Fences and walls and sheds stood staunchly out in the yellow afternoon, and they were related, too. There was change in everything. A flight of sparrows dropped into the dust and scrabbled for bits of food, and then flew off like a gray scarf twisting in the light. Adam looked back at his brother. He had lost track of time, and he didn't know how long he had been standing in the doorway. No time had passed. Charles was still struggling with the same large stone, and Adam hadn't released the full, held breath he had taken when time stopped. Suddenly he knew joy and sorrow felted into one fabric. Courage and fear were one thing, too. He found that he had started to hum a droning little tune. He turned, walked through the kitchen, and stood in the doorway, looking at Kathy. She smiled weakly at him, and he thought, what a child, what a helpless child, and a surge of love filled him. "Will you marry me?" he asked. Her face tightened, and her hand closed convulsively. "You don't have to tell me now," he said. "I want you to think about it. But if you would marry me, I could protect you. No one could hurt you again." Kathy recovered in an instant. "Come here, Adam. There, sit down. Here, give me your hand. That's good, that's right." She raised his hand and put the back of it against her cheek. "My dear," she said brokenly. "Oh, my dear. Look, Adam, you have trusted me. Now, will you promise me something? Will you promise not to tell your brother you have asked me?"
"Asked you to marry me? Why shouldn't I?"
"It's not that. I want this night to think. I'll want maybe more than this night. Could you let me do that?"
She raised her hand to her head.
"You know, I'm not sure I can think straight, and I want to."
"Do you think you might marry me?"
"Please, Adam, let me alone to think. Please, my dear."
He smiled and said nervously,
"Don't make it long. I'm kind of like a cat up a tree so far he can't come down."
"Just let me think. And, Adam, you're a kind man."
He went outside and walked toward where his brother was loading stones. When he was gone, Kathy got up from her bed and moved unsteadily to the bureau. She leaned forward and looked at her face. The bandage was still on her forehead. She raised the edge of it enough to see the angry red underneath. She had not only made up her mind to marry Adam, but she had so decided before he had asked her. She was afraid. She needed protection and money. Adam could give her both, and she could control him. She knew that. She didn't want to be married, but for the time being it was a refuge. Only one thing bothered her. Adam had a warmth toward her which she did not understand, since she had none toward him, nor had ever experienced it toward anyone. And Mr. Edwards had really frightened her. That had been the only time in her life she had lost control of a situation. She determined never to let it happen again. She smiled to herself when she thought what Charles would say. She felt a kinship to Charles. She didn't mind his suspicion of her. Charles straightened up when Adam approached. He
He put his palms against the small of his back and massaged the tired muscles.
My God, there's lots of rocks, he said.
Fellow in the army told me there's valleys in California, miles and miles, and you can't find a stone, not even a little one.
There'll be something else, said Charles. I don't think there's any farm without something wrong with it. Out in the Middle West, it's locusts. Someplace else, it's tornadoes. What's a few stones?
I guess you're right. I thought I'd give you a hand.
That's nice of you. I thought you'd spend the rest of your life holding hands with that in there. How long is she going to stay?
Adam was on the point of telling him of his proposal, but the tone of Charles' voice made him change his mind.
Say, Charles said, Alex Platt came by a little while ago. You'd never think what happened to him. He's found a fortune.
How do you mean?
Well, you know the place on his property where that clump of cedars sticks out? You know, right on the county road.
I know. What about it?
Alex went in between those trees and a stone wall. He was hunting rabbits. He found a suitcase and a man's clothes, all packed nice. Soaked up with rain, though. Looked like it had been there some time. And there was a wood box with a lock. And when he broke it open, there was near $4,000 in it. And he found a purse, too. There wasn't anything in it.
No name or anything?
That's the strange part. No name. No name on the clothes, no labels on the suits. It's just like the fellow didn't want to be traced.
Is Alex going to keep it?
He took it into the sheriff, and the sheriff is going to advertise it. And if nobody answers, Alex can keep it.
Somebody's sure to claim it.
I guess so. I didn't tell Alex that. He's feeling so good about it. That's funny, no labels. Not cut out, just didn't have any.
That's a lot of money, Adam said. Somebody's bound to claim it.
Alex hung around for a while. You know, his wife goes around a lot.
Charles was silent.
Adam, he said finally, we gotta have a talk. The whole county's doing plenty of talking.
About what? What do you mean?
God damn it, about that girl. Two men can't have a girl living with them. Alex says the women are pretty riled up about it. Adam, we can't have it. We live here. We've got a good name.
You want me to throw her out before she's well?
I want you to get rid of her. Get her out. I don't like her.
You never have.
I know it. I don't trust her. There's something, I don't know what it is, but I don't like it. When are you going to get her out?
Tell you what, Adam said slowly. Give her one more week, and then I'll do something about her.
You promise?
Sure, I promise.
Well, that's something. I'll get the word to Alex's wife. From there on, she'll handle the news. Good Lord, I'll be glad to have the house to ourselves again. I don't suppose her memories come back.
No, said Adam.
Five days later, when Charles had gone to buy some calf feed, Adam drove the buggy to the kitchen steps. He helped Kathy in, tucked a blanket around her knees, and put another around her shoulders. He drove to the county seat and was married to her by a justice of the peace. Charles was home when they returned. He looked sourly at them when they came into the kitchen.
I thought you took her in to put her on the train.
We got married,
Adam said simply. Kathy smiled at Charles.
Why? Why did you do it?
Why not? Can't a man get married?
Kathy went quickly into the bedroom and closed the door. Charles began to rave.
She's no damn good, I tell you. She's a whore.
Charles,
I tell you, she's just a two-bit whore. I wouldn't trust her with a bit piece. That bitch, that slut.
Charles, stop it. Stop it, I tell you.
You keep your filthy mouth shut about my wife. She's no more a wife than an alley cat.
Adam said slowly, I think you're jealous, Charles. I think you wanted to marry her.
Why, you goddamn fool. Me jealous? I won't live in the same house with her.
Adam said evenly, you won't have to. I'm going away. You can buy me out if you want. You can have the farm. You always wanted it. You can stay here and rot.
Charles' voice lowered.
Won't you get rid of her? Please, Adam, throw her out. She'll tear you to pieces. She'll destroy you, Adam. She'll destroy you.
How do you know so much about her?
Charles' eyes were bleak.
I don't,
he said, and his mouth snapped shut. Adam didn't even ask Kathy whether she wanted to come out for dinner. He carried two plates into the bedroom and sat beside her.
We're going to go away, he said. Let me go away. Please, let me. I don't want to make you hate your brother. I wonder why he hates me.
I think he's jealous.
Her eyes narrowed.
Jealous?
That's what it looks like to me. You don't have to worry. We're getting out. We're going to California.
She said quietly.
I don't want to go to California.
Nonsense. It's nice there. Sun all the time and beautiful.
I don't want to go to California.
You're my wife, he said softly. I want you to go with me.
She was silent and didn't speak of it again. They heard Charles slam out the door, and Adam said,
That'll be good for him. He'll get a little drunk and he'll feel better.
Kathy modestly looked at her fingers.
Adam, I can't be a wife to you until I'm well.
I know, he said. I understand. I'll wait.
But I want you to stay with me. I'm afraid of Charles. He hates me so.
I'll bring my cot in here. Then you can call me if you're frightened. You can reach out and touch me.
You're so good, she said. Could we have some tea?
Why, sure. I'd like some myself.
He brought the steaming cups in and went back for the sugar bowl. He settled himself in a chair near her bed.
It's pretty strong. Is it too strong for you?
I like it strong.
He finished his cup.
Does it taste strange to you? It's got a funny taste.
Her hand flew to her mouth.
Oh, let me taste it.
She sipped the dregs.
Adam, she cried, you got the wrong cup. That was mine. It had my medicine in it.
He licked his lips.
I guess it can't hurt me.
No, it can't, she laughed softly. I hope I don't need to call you in the night.
What do you mean?
Well, you drank my sleeping medicine. Maybe you wouldn't wake up easily.
Adam went down into a heavy opium sleep, though he fought to stay awake.
Did the doctor tell you to take this much? He asked thickly.
You're just not used to it, she said.
Charles came back at 11 o'clock. Kathy heard his tipsy footsteps. He went into his room, flung off his clothes, and got into bed. He grunted and turned, trying to get comfortable, and then he opened his eyes. Kathy was standing by his bed.
What do you want?
What do you think? Move over a little.
Where's Adam?
He drank my sleeping medicine by mistake. Move over a little.
He breathed harshly.
I've already been with a whore.
You're a pretty strong boy. Move over a little.
How about your broken arm?
I'll take care of that. It's not your worry.
Suddenly Charles laughed.
That poor bastard, he said,
and he threw back the blanket to receive her. Part 2. Chapter 12. You can see how this book has reached a great boundary that was called 1900. Another 100 years were ground up and churned. And what had happened was all muddied by the way folks wanted it to be. More rich and meaningful the farther back it was. In the books of some memories, it was the best time that ever sloshed over the world. The old time, the gay time, sweet and simple, as though time were young and fearless. Old men who didn't know whether they were going to stagger over the boundary of the century looked forward to it with distaste. For the world was changing. The sweetness was gone, and virtue too. Worry had crept on a corroding world, and what was lost, good manners, ease, and beauty. Ladies weren't ladies anymore, and you couldn't trust a gentleman's word. There was a time when people kept their fly buttons fastened, and man's freedom was boiling off. And even childhood was no good anymore, not the way it was. No worry then but how to find a good stone, not round exactly, but flattened and water-shaped, to use in a sling pouch cut from a discarded shoe. Where did all the good stones go, and all simplicity? A man's mind vagued up a little, for how can you remember the feel of pleasure or pain or choking emotion? You can remember only that you had them. An elder man might truly recall through water the delicate doctor testing of little girls, but such a man forgets and wants to the acid emotion eating at the spleen, so that a boy had to put his face flat down on the young wild oats and drum his fists against the ground and sob, "Christ, Christ!" Such a man might say, and did, "What's that damn kid lying out there in the grass for? He'll catch a cold." Oh, strawberries don't taste as they used to, and the thighs of women have lost their clutch. And some men ease themselves like setting hens into the nest of death. History was secreted in the glands of a million historians. "We must get out of this banged-up century," some said, "out of this cheating, murderous century of riot and secret death, of scrabbling for public lands and damn well getting them by any means at all." Think back. Recall our little nation fringing the oceans, torn with complexities, too big for its britches. Just got going when the British took us on again. We beat them, but it didn't do us much good. What we had was a burned White House and 10,000 widows on the public pension list. Then the soldiers went to Mexico, and it was a kind of painful picnic. Nobody knows why you go to a picnic to be uncomfortable when it's so easy and pleasant to eat at home. The Mexican War did two good things, though. We got a lot of western land, damn near doubled our size. And besides that, it was a training ground for generals, so that when the sad self-murder settled on us, the leaders knew the techniques for making it properly horrible. And then the arguments. Can you keep a slave? Well, if you bought him in good faith, why not? Next they'll be saying a man can't have a horse. Who is it wants to take my property? And there we were, like a man scratching at his own face and bleeding into his own beard. Well, that was over, and we got slowly up off the bloody ground and started westward. There came boom and bust, bankruptcy, depression. Great public thieves came along and picked the pockets of everyone who had a pocket. To hell with that rotten century. Let's get it over and the door closed shut on it. Let's close it like a book and go on reading. New chapter, new life. A man will have clean hands once we get the lid slammed shut on that stinking century. It's a fair thing ahead. There's no rot on this clean new 100 years.
It's not stacked. And any bastard who deals seconds from this new deck of years, why, we'll crucify him head down over a privy. Oh, but strawberries will never taste so good again. And the thighs of women have lost their clutch.
Chapter 13. Sometimes a kind of glory lights up the mind of a man. It happens to nearly everyone. You can feel it growing or preparing like a fuse burning toward dynamite. It's a feeling in the stomach, a delight of the nerves, of the forearms. The skin tastes the air, and every deep-drawn breath is sweet. Its beginning has the pleasure of a great stretching yawn. It flashes in the brain, and the whole world glows outside your eyes. A man may have lived all of his life in the gray, and the land and trees of him dark and somber. The events, even the important ones, may have trooped by, faceless and pale. And then, the glory. So that a cricket song sweetens his ears, the smell of the earth rises chanting to his nose, and dappling light under a tree blesses his eyes. Then a man pours outward, a torrent of him, and yet he isn't diminished. And I guess a man's importance in the world can be measured by the quality and number of his glories. It is a lonely thing, but it relates us to the world. It is the mother of all creativeness, and it sets each man separate from all other men. I don't know how it will be in years to come. There are monstrous changes taking place in the world, forces shaping a future whose face we don't know. Some of these forces seem evil to us, perhaps not in themselves, but because their tendency is to eliminate other things we hold good. It is true that two men can lift a bigger stone than one man. A group can build automobiles quicker and better than one man. And bread from a huge factory is cheaper and more uniform. When our food and clothing and housing all are born in the complication of mass production, mass method is bound to get into our thinking and to eliminate all other thinking. In our time, mass or collective production has entered our economics, our politics, and even our religion, so that some nations have substituted the idea collective for the idea God. This, in my time, is the danger. There is great tension in the world, tension toward a breaking point, and men are unhappy and confused. At such a time, it seems natural and good to me to ask myself these questions. What do I believe in? What must I fight for? And what must I fight against? Our species is the only creative species, and it has only one creative instrument, the individual mind and spirit of a man. Nothing was ever created by two men. There are no good collaborations, whether in music, in art, in poetry, in mathematics, in philosophy. Once the miracle of creation has taken place, the group can build and extend it, but the group never invents anything. The preciousness lies in the lonely mind of a man. And now the forces marshaled around the concept of the group have declared a war of extermination on that preciousness, the mind of man. By disparagement, by starvation, by repressions, forced direction, and the stunning hammer blows of conditioning, the free, roving mind is being pursued, roped, blunted, drugged. It is a sad, suicidal course our species seems to have taken. And this, I believe, that the free, exploring mind of the individual human is the most valuable thing in the world. And this I would fight for, the freedom of the mind to take any direction it wishes, undirected. And this I must fight against, any idea, religion, or government which limits or destroys the individual. This is what I am and what I am about. I can understand why a system built on a pattern must try to destroy the free mind, for that is one thing which can, by inspection, destroy such a system. Surely I can understand this, and I hate it, and I will fight against it to preserve the one thing that separates us from the uncreative beasts. If the glory can be killed, we are lost. Adam Trask grew up in grayness, and the curtains of his life were like dusty cobwebs, and his days a slow file of half-sorrows and sick dissatisfactions. And then, through Kathy, the glory came to him. It doesn't matter that Kathy was what I have called a monster. Perhaps we can't understand Kathy, but on the other hand, we are capable of many things in all directions, of great virtues and great sins. And who in his mind has not probed the black water? Maybe we all have in us a secret pond where evil and ugly things germinate and grow strong. But this culture is fenced, and the swimming brood climbs up only to fall back. Might it not be that in the dark pools of some men, the evil grows strong enough to wiggle over the fence and swim free? Would not such a man be our monster? And are we not related to him in our hidden water? It would be absurd if we didn't understand both angels and devils, since we invented them. Whatever Kathy may have been, she set off the glory in Adam. His spirit rose flying and released him from fear and bitterness and rancid memories. The glory lights up the world and changes it the way a star shell changes a battleground. Perhaps Adam did not see Kathy at all, so lighted was she by his eyes. Burned in his mind was an image of beauty and tenderness, a sweet and holy girl, precious beyond thinking, clean and loving. And that image was Kathy to her husband, and nothing Kathy did or said could warp Adam's Kathy. She said she didn't want to go to California, and he didn't listen, because his Kathy took his arm and started first. So bright was his glory that he didn't notice the sullen pain in his brother, didn't see the glinting in his brother's eyes. He sold his share of the farm to Charles for less than it was worth, and with that and his half of his father's money, he was free and rich. The brothers were strangers now. They shook hands at the station, and Charles watched the train pull out and rubbed his scar. He went to the inn, drank 4 quick whiskies, and climbed the stairs to the top floor. He paid the girl, and then couldn't perform. He cried in her arms until she put him out. He raged at his farm, forced it, added to it, drilled and trimmed, and his boundaries extended. He took no rest, no recreation, and he became rich without pleasure, and respected without friends. Adam stopped in New York long enough to buy clothes for himself and Kathy before they climbed on the train which bore them across the continent. How they happened to go to the Salinas Valley is very easy to understand. In that day, the railroads, growing, fighting among themselves, striving to increase and to dominate, used every means to increase their traffic. The companies not only advertised in the newspapers, they issued booklets and broadsides describing and picturing the beauty and richness of the West. No claim was too extravagant. Wealth was unlimited. The Southern Pacific Railroad, headed by the wild energy of Leland Stanford, had begun to dominate the Pacific coast, not only in transportation, but in politics. Its rails extended down the valleys. New towns sprang up. New sections were opened and populated. For the company had to create customers to get custom. The long Salinas Valley was part of the exploitation. Adam had seen and studied a fine color broadside, which set forth the valley as that region which heaven unsuccessfully imitated. After reading the literature, anyone who didn't want to settle in the Salinas Valley was crazy. Adam didn't rush at his purchase. He bought a rig and drove around, meeting the earlier comers, talking of soil and water, climate and crops, prices and facilities. It wasn't speculation with Adam. He was here to settle, to found a home, a family, perhaps a dynasty. Adam drove exuberantly from farm to farm, picked up dirt and crumbled it in his fingers, talked and planned and dreamed. The people of the valley liked him and were glad he had come to live there, for they recognized a man of substance. He had only one worry, and that was for Kathy. She wasn't well. She rode around the country with him, but she was listless. One morning she complained of feeling ill and stayed in a room in the King City Hotel while Adam drove into the country. He returned at about 5 in the afternoon to find her nearly dead from loss of blood. Luckily, Adam found Dr. Tilson at his supper and dragged him from his roast beef. The doctor made a quick examination, inserted a packing, and turned to Adam. "Why don't you wait downstairs?" he suggested.
"Is she all right?"
"Yes, I'll call you pretty soon." Adam patted Kathy's shoulder, and she smiled up at him. Dr. Tilson closed the door behind him and came back to the bed. His face was red with anger.
"Why did you do it?"
Kathy's mouth was a thin, tight line.
"Does your husband know you're pregnant?"
Her head moved slowly from side to side.
"What did you do it with?"
She stared up at him. He looked around the room. He stepped to the bureau and picked up a knitting needle. He shook it in her face.
"The old offender, the old criminal," he said. "You're a fool. You've nearly killed yourself, and you haven't lost your baby. I suppose you took things, too. Poisoned yourself. Inserted camphor, kerosene, red pepper. My God, some of the things you women do."
Her eyes were as cold as glass. He pulled a chair up beside her bed.
"Why don't you want to have the baby?"
he asked softly. "You've got a good husband. Don't you love him?
Don't you intend to speak to me at all? Tell me, damn it. Don't turn mulish."
Her lips didn't move, and her eyes didn't flicker.
"My dear," he said, "can't you see? You must not destroy life. That's the one thing gets me crazy. God knows I lose patience because I don't know enough, but I try, I always try, and then I see a deliberate killing."
He talked rapidly on. He dreaded the sick silence between his sentences. This woman puzzled him. There was something inhuman about her.
"Have you met Mrs. Laurel? She's wasting and crying for a baby. Everything she has or can get, she would give to have a baby. And you try to stab yours with a knitting needle." "All right," he cried. "You won't speak. You don't have to. But I'm going to tell you. The baby is safe. Your aim was bad. And I'm telling you this. You're going to have that baby. Do you know what the law in this state has to say about abortion? You don't have to answer, but you listen to me. If this happens again, if you lose this baby, and I have any reason to suspect monkey business, I will charge you. I'll testify against you, and I will see you punished. Now, I hope you have sense enough to believe me, because I mean it."
Kathy moistened her lips with a little pointed tongue. The cold went out of her eyes, and a weak sadness took its place.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sorry. But you don't understand."
"Then why don't you tell me?"
His anger disappeared like mist.
"Tell me, my dear."
"It's hard to tell. Adam is so good, so strong. I'm tainted. Epilepsy."
"Not you."
"No, but my grandfather and my father. And my brother."
She covered her hands with her eyes.
"I couldn't bring that to my husband."
"Poor child," he said. "Poor child. You can't be certain. It's more than probable that your baby will be fine and healthy. Will you promise me not to try any more tricks?"
"Yes."
"All right, then. I won't tell your husband what you did. Now lie back and let me see if the bleeding stopped."
In a few minutes, he closed his satchel and put the knitting needle in his pocket. "I'll look in tomorrow morning," he said. Adam swarmed on him as he came down the narrow stairs into the lobby. Dr. Tilson warded off the flurry of, "How is she? Is she all right? What caused it? Can I go up?" "Whoa, hold up, hold up." And he used his trick, his standard joke. "Your wife is sick."
"Doctor!"
"She has the only good sickness there is."
"Doctor!"
"Your wife is going to have a baby." He brushed past Adam and left him staring. Three men sitting around the stove grinned at him. One of them observed dryly, "If it was me now, why, I'd invite a few, maybe three, friends to have a drink." His hint was wasted. Adam bolted clumsily up the narrow stairs. Adam's attention narrowed to the Bordoni Ranch, a few miles south of King City, almost equidistant, in fact, between San Lucas and King City. The Bordonis had 900 acres left of a grant of 10,000 acres, which had come to Mrs. Bordoni's great-grandfather from the Spanish crown. The Bordonis were Swiss, but Mrs. Bordoni was the daughter and heiress of a Spanish family that had settled in the Salinas Valley in very early times. And as happened with most of the old families, the land slipped away. Some was lost in gambling, some chipped off for taxes, and some acres torn off like coupons to buy luxuries, a horse, a diamond, or a pretty woman. The 900 remaining acres were the core of the original Sanchez grant, and the best of it, too. They straddled the river and tucked into the foothills on both sides, for at this point the valley narrows and then opens out again. The original Sanchez house was still usable. Built of adobe, it stood on a tiny opening in the foothills, a miniature valley fed by a precious, ever-running spring of sweet water. That, of course, was why the first Sanchez had built his seed here. Huge live oaks shaded the valley, and the earth had a richness and a greenness foreign to this part of the country. The walls of the low house were 4 feet thick, and the round pole rafters were tied on with rawhide ropes, which had been put on wet. The hide shrank and pulled joist and rafter tight together, and the leather ropes became hard as iron and nearly imperishable. There is only one drawback to this building method. Rats will gnaw at the hide if they are let. The old house seemed to have grown out of the earth, and it was lovely. Bordoni used it for a cow barn. He was a Swiss, an immigrant with his national passion for cleanliness. He distrusted the thick mud walls and built a frame house some distance away, and his cows put their heads out of the deep recessed windows of the old Sanchez house. The Bordonis were childless, and when the wife died in ripe years, a lonely longing for his alpine past fell on her husband. He wanted to sell the ranch and go home. Adam Trask refused to buy in a hurry, and Bordoni was asking a big price, and using the selling method of pretending not to care whether he sold or not. Bordoni knew Adam was going to buy his land long before Adam knew it. Where Adam settled, he intended to stay and to have his unborn children stay. He was afraid he might buy one place and then see another he liked better. And all the time, the Sanchez place was drawing him. With the advent of Kathy, his life extended long and pleasantly ahead of him. But he went through all the motions of carefulness. He drove and rode and walked over every foot of the land. He put a post-hole auger down through the subsoil to test and feel and smell the under-earth. He inquired about the small wild plants of field and riverside and hill. In damp places, he knelt down and examined the game tracks in the mud. Mountain lion and deer, coyote and wild cat, skunk and raccoon, weasel and rabbit, all overlaid with the pattern of quail tracks. He threaded among willows and sycamores and wild blackberry vines in the riverbed, patted the trunks of live oak and scrub oak, madrone, laurel, toyon. Bordoni watched him with squinting eyes and poured tumblers of red wine squeezed from the grapes in his small hillside vineyard. It was Bordoni's pleasure to get a little drunk every afternoon, and Adam, who had never tasted wine, began to like it. Over and over he asked Kathy's opinion of the place. Did she like it? Would she be happy there? And he didn't listen to her noncommittal answers. He thought that she linked arms with his enthusiasm. In the lobby of the King City Hotel, he talked to the man who gathered around the stove and read the papers sent down from San Francisco. "It's water I think about," he said one evening. "I wonder how deep you'd have to go to bring in a well." A rancher crossed his denim knees. "You gotta go see Sam Hamilton," he said. "He knows more about water than anybody around here. He's a water witch and a well digger, too. He'll tell you. He's put down half the wells in this part of the valley." His companion chuckled. "Sam's got a real legitimate reason to be interested in water. He hasn't a goddamn drop of it on his own place." "How do I find him?" Adam asked. "I'll tell you what. I'm going out to have him make some angle irons. I'll take you with me if you want. You'll like Mr. Hamilton. He's a fine man." "Kind of a comical genius," his companion said.
This ends Disc 5. East of Eden, Disc 6.
They went to the Hamilton Ranch in Louis Lippo's buckboard. Louis and Adam Trask. The iron straps rattled around in the box, and a leg of venison, wrapped in wet burlap to keep it cool, jumped around on top of the iron. It was customary in that day to take some substantial lump of food as a present when you went calling on a man, for you had to stay to dinner unless you wished to insult his house. But a few guests could set back the feeding plans for a week if you didn't build up what you destroyed. A quarter of pork or a rump of beef would do. Lewis had cut down the venison, and Adam provided a bottle of whiskey. "Now, I'll have to tell you," Lewis said, "Mr. Hamilton will like that, but Mrs. Hamilton has got a scunner on it. If I was you, I'd leave it under the seat, and when we drive around to the shop, why, then you can get it out. That's what we always do." "Doesn't she let her husband take a drink?" "No bigger than a bird," said Lewis, "but she's got brass-bound opinions. Just you leave the bottle under the seat." They left the valley road and drove into the worn and rutted hills, over a set of wheel tracks gullied by the winter rains. The horses strained under their collars, and the buckboard rocked and swayed. The year had not been kind to the hills, and already in June they were dry, and the stones showed through the short burned feed. The wild oats had headed out barely 6 inches above the ground, as though with knowledge that if they didn't make seed quickly, they wouldn't get to seed at all. "It's not likely-looking country," Adam said. "Likely? Why, Mr. Trask, it's country that'll break a man's heart and eat him up. Likely. Mr. Hamilton has a sizable piece, and he'd have starved to death on it with all those children. The ranch don't feed them. He does all kinds of jobs, and his boys are starting to bring in something now. It's a fine family." Adam stared at a line of dark mesquite that peeked out of a draw. "Why in the world would he settle on a place like this?" Louis Lippo, as does every man, loved to interpret, to a stranger particularly, if no native was present to put up an argument. "I'll tell you," he said. "Take me. My father was Italian. Came here after the trouble, but he brought a little money. My place isn't very big, but it's nice. My father bought it. He picked it out. And take you. I don't know how you're fixed, and I wouldn't ask, but they say you're trying to buy the old Sanchez place, and Bordoni never gave anything away. You're pretty well fixed, or you wouldn't even ask about it."
"I'm comfortably off," said Adam modestly.
"I'm talking the long way around," said Lewis. "When Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton came into the valley, they didn't have a pot to piss in. They had to take what was left, government land that nobody else wanted. 25 acres of it won't keep a cow alive, even in good years. And they say the coyotes move away in bad years. There's people say they don't know how the Hamiltons lived. But of course Mr. Hamilton went right to work. That's how they lived. Worked as a hired hand till he got his threshing machine built.
Must have made a go of it. I hear of him all over."
"He made a go of it, all right. Raised 9 children.
I'll bet he hasn't got 4 bits laid away. How could he?
One side of the buckboard leaped up.